One of the most bizarre instruments discovered by the team was a triangular-shaped object about the size of a quarter, 25-cent piece. When the item was placed on a person's head, it instantly embedded itself in the skull, rendered the person unconscious, then lifted him up headfirst and vanished, taking the body with it. At first, those performing the experiment assumed that the body was transported back to the ship. This was before the advent of Star Trek, so none of them were familiar with the famous words, "Beam me up, Scotty." This experiment was one that was done in Korea during the war, to a wounded prisoner. The alien craft was parked somewhere in Okinawa, so they flew back to where it was to see if that person was in the alien ship. They presumed that, like the other alien objects connected with the ship, that maybe they had discovered a unique and quick way to get back to the ship from any place on the planet. But the person was not transported back to the ship. However, 3 days later, the triangular device was back on the craft. The person or his body was never found. The prevailing theory of what might have happened to him was that he was transported to some other alien ship in Earth's orbit, or possibly to the interior of the planet, where it was suspected by one of the clairvoyants that the aliens had an outpost. A second psychic stated that the body was carried into the sun to be destroyed, for reasons he could not understand or explain to the committee. Like all the experiments that have been carried out using the alien gadgets, it too only worked on the living. One other theory that came from the research team, who studied that devilish device, was that the soul, or essence of what humans are, had something to do with the destination of the person. Another team supported that theory when they discovered in the course of their experiments that those who lost brain activity during their experiment also lost the function of the alien instruments. The gadgets simply became dormant. Even when the man was kept alive artificially, the lack of brain waves rendered the devices useless. In every situation, the alien devices stopped working the moment the brain waves stopped. It appeared that the aliens had jurisdiction over humans only to the extent they remained alive. It was painfully obvious to the committee that the aliens were capable of doing whatever they desired to do when it came to humans. So what were the aliens up to? Some of the questions that were tossed around by committee members: how many aliens are on this planet? Dozens? Hundreds? Thousands? Did they want humans to participate by letting us have one of their vessels? Ships filled with supernatural instruments and gadgets? Why are they being secretive and not making some kind of formal contact with Earthlings? Did they stage the alien shipwreck? Was it a means of introducing their infinity superior race to our fragile inferior race? Perhaps the aliens wanted to let us know that we could not survive or handle full disclosure with them. Are they sowing the seeds for our destruction right under our noses? If the government is keeping this little project under tight wraps, are there other projects going on simultaneously? How many covered projects, and do other countries have them too? There were plenty of questions such as those, but few if any definitive answers. As fragments of the puzzle came together, the committee deduced from the alien gadgets that the aliens had a definite interest in the human anatomy. To what extent, they didn't have a clue. Since many of the instruments had beneficial features to them, were the aliens a kind of behind-the-scenes paramedic unit? If so, why are they selective? Thousands of people die every day of accidents and diseases that could easily be treated with the gadgets that the aliens have. For a period of a few months, the committee switched gears and spent more time brainstorming on what was the purpose of the intruders, especially in the area of national security. Did the aliens pose an immediate risk to the country or to the world? That was the bottom line for the committee to determine. The committee enlisted the aid of additional clairvoyants and had them concentrate solely on making contact with extraterrestrial beings. The committee had no access to the captured aliens after the discovery of the saucer. At the time, they didn't care. They had plenty on their plate with the alien craft and its cargo. But during the late 60s and early 70s, the committee needed to understand the connection between the two. The aliens had some fantastic stuff, but why did they have this stuff? The committee was denied access to the aliens that piloted the ship, and was not allowed to know their location or even if they were still alive. Therefore, to get answers to why the aliens hid that stuff, they had to find their own aliens and ask them. They tried using the clairvoyants in various numerical groupings to see if they could concentrate and direct their power to locate aliens. That failed to produce any results, so they were back to square one and they let them work individually again. Of the 6 or 7 clairvoyants on the team, one was predicting with 65% accuracy on where alien sightings would occur, the rest missed every time. Throughout the 60s and 70s, members of the committee crisscrossed TH things. Members of the committee photographed the UFOs, they chased them with fighter jets and choppers, and when the terrain allowed and there were no civilians in the vicinity, they attempted to shoot the UFOs down. They never came close to hitting a UFO, but no one in the committee thought they would. Their intentions were strictly to see if the aliens would respond, acknowledge them in some way, by blinking their lights or zapping the committee's aircraft with a ray beam, something. Humorous was the cry of one frustrated committee member. After 2 disappointing decades of seeing UFOs, without making any actual contact, the committee decided to change their approach and focus on what or who the aliens were visiting. The committee members read the papers and the tabloids, so they were aware of all the stories of alien abductions. They even interviewed some of the more prominent people abducted but came away with no answers. Even thought the committee was part of a secret government agency with virtually unlimited resources, high-level contacts and access to a myriad of public and private institutions. They ran into the same brick walls that stymied everyone who attempted to get classified information about secret projects. Therefore, other covert committees that had more knowledge about extraterrestrials remained unavailable to them. That committee was financed through the Department of the Air Force, and as everyone knows, those high up who work for the government, there can be no favoritism of one branch of their government over another by the Congress of the United States. That's doubly true for the Pentagon. If one department of the military had a secret government committee, then all of them have 1 or 2. Or perhaps dozens. The committee didn't want to get involved with those people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens. No specific reason was given. They were hoping that if there were another department that already did that perhaps they could borrow that information from that group. Obviously someone had possession of the aliens, dead or alive, and that committee had information that might benefit this committee. Whether it was policy or bureaucracy, committees were not allowed to share information with each other. Unable to breach those hidden barriers, the committee had to do their own investigations. The committee avoided dealing with abductees even though the committee knew that some were telling the truth. The few people that did get interviewed seemed to have ulterior motives for their claims. Some were only interested in a government payout. They would talk all day long about their experiences for a fee. Or they were looking to blame their mental problems on the alien abductions, or the government, who many believed were behind the abductions. Overall, many of the abductees were looking for attention and offered little if any reliable information. The committee needed to know why these people was being abducted and those claiming to have been had no clue to why. Detecting a UFO was much easier than finding out what the aliens were up to. Locating a UFO was only a matter of coordinating their best psychic with their ground and their team. Once the psychic pinpointed the location where he felt a UFO might be, the ground team scoured that area until they confirmed it. After verification, they dispatched a specially equipped airplane that carried a multitude of radar and other sophisticated tracking devices to that sector. When the Air Force surveillance plane located a UFO, they kept an eye on the craft from a distance of several miles and transmitted pertinent information to the ground vehicles. They never used more than 2 ordinary cars, civilian, and remained incognito throughout the surveillance. The committee knew they were not sneaking up on the aliens or able to fool them in any way. They were more concerned with tipping off ordinary citizens but mostly UFO buffs, who regularly showed up at many of the same places the committee did. Headline: layers added to shield the president. The committee began reporting all new findings and other discoveries to a newly created agency rather than directly to the president as they had done in the past. The new procedure was put into place between 1974 and 1976 for the sole purpose of isolating the executive branch from certain covert operations. In the committee's first report to the new agency, which was dated July 30, 1976, the date itself is a coded message, and had no significance to an actual day or year. They described the failure of the committee to identify anyone who the aliens were making contact with on this planet. The duration of the surveillance was 8 months and it produced 271 sightings, but not once was an alien craft observed taking or leaving human subjects. Alien ships were observed in residential neighborhoods, in open fields, and sometimes in the midst of large cities hovering amid skyscrapers. The sightings lasted from a split second to one of the longest recorded by the committee, which was 5 hours. The committee believed that time had no relevance to the sightings. They came to that conclusion when they noticed that on more than one occasion, when they had visual and radar contact of an alien craft, people on the street were completely unaware of what was taking place a short distance above their heads. "We were either having mass hallucination among ourselves, and/or the radar and other equipment malfunctioned simultaneously. We had visual contact as well as equipment contact," explained one of the committee members at the sighting. The logical conclusion was that the aliens were demonstrating to the committee their supernatural abilities to be seen or not to be seen, and by whom. It was a disturbing realization to the committee when they contemplated the implications of what the aliens were capable of doing. The whole operation came to a halt before they were done because of an emotional breakdown that struck nearly every member on the team. 2 committee members had a nervous breakdown, 3 others developed similar psychosomatic illnesses and were absent for several weeks, and 2 quit the program. Whether it was a coincidence or not, this all happened the week they ended the surveillance campaign. That entire week was dedicated to hash over and reviewed most of the material from the previous 8 months of fieldwork. The details were increasingly more disturbing as they tried to ponder over and over again what it all meant. They knew they did not have all the facts, or possibly none of the facts, but what little they had was disturbing. There are hundreds of mental hospitals in the world that are filled with people who have claimed to see things that no one else, normal people, sees. Are the hospitals full of the wrong people? They wondered. Is it possible that many of the so-called mentally disturbed people are actually people who have been abducted and don't know it? Or are the committee members themselves psychotic and living this grand illusion that they have possession of a fantastical alien craft? A number of committee members throughout the program have lost touch with reality. Or perhaps they came in touch with reality and therefore were no longer capable of functioning in the chaotic world normal people call reality. Nonetheless, they were institutionalized with what was described as irreversible psychosis. How many scientists succumbed was not mentioned. At first it was believed that contact with something on the alien craft might have brought on their mental disease. Entering the ship literally alters the mind. All concepts of time and space are skewed while inside the ship, truly a mind-altering experience. The problem with that theory was that many other scientists who worked around the same alien things were not affected. The subject was dropped when it was pointed out to the committee that their job was not to figure out why psychosis happens but why aliens happen. There was little doubt in any of the committee members' minds that secrecy is the only policy. A consensus agreed to by the newly organized committee. The thought that there could be thousands of these alien ships flying around, showing themselves selectively to whomever they wanted to, was unnerving for those who knew about it. If those in the secret programs could barely maintain their focus with that kind of knowledge, much less their sanity, how then would the country or the entire world react if suddenly such information became public? That mankind is under some giant microscope and being observed by higher intelligent beings. If that information were to get out, would people continue in their daily routines of working, buying, playing, investing, and doing the millions of things that keep the economies of the world churning along? How would the news affect the stock markets? Any significant disruption would ripple across world markets and perhaps cause them to collapse, destroying whole economies. The end result would be anarchy. The planet would be primed for a dictatorship. A new world order would fill the void on the planet, possibly a new order installed by aliens. Headline: Pandora's Box. Although the committee was unable to catch the aliens in the act of abducting humans, some of their researchers were making substantial discoveries with the items found on the craft. One item that was discovered inside the alien craft was shaped like a cigar box. It performed a similar function as the black chalk, by creating doorways through barriers, except that this box allowed more than one person at a time to penetrate walls. It had symbols on the top and three slight impressions on the cover or the lid of the box. That box had apparently been overlooked, or it was placed there by aliens decades after the crash. No one could be sure. The box did not have a lid that swung up or any moving parts to it. It operated like the opening of the alien spacecraft. An opening happened, but not by simple desire concerning the box. The three impressions on the top acted like a combination lock. Once the correct sequence was entered, an opening appeared and revealed a variety of geometrically diverse objects. No mention was made on how they broke the code or how long it took them to figure out how to open the box. When the box opened, it automatically engulfed everyone in its vicinity into an envelope of what was described as a strange cloud of electricity. One could easily walk in and out of its electric field without being harmed by it, but it left an eerie feeling with those who experienced it. The envelope resembled an electrified cellophane membrane that made it easy to define the boundaries. The envelope's capacity seemed endless. There was no apparent fixed range to it. It simply expanded to the task required. If there were two people, it encompassed the two. When there were more people, it embraced the larger group. It did not reach out to an individual or follow him if he or she strayed from the main contingent. It sensed what was required and performed accordingly. The envelope allowed those within it to walk through any barrier as well as walk on air. They didn't hover, they walked on an invisible platform. Barriers disobeyed the laws of physics when the strange mist that emanated from the box engulfed them. That box was the key to how the aliens abducted people from the most bizarre situations, from moving cars, airplanes while in flight, and from the upper stories of skyscrapers through sealed glass. Those were happenings and situations that would give the most daring of stuntmen nightmares. The abducted that were interviewed by committee members insisted that doors were never opened, locks were not broken, and that the aliens simply permeated through the walls and into their bedrooms and carried them, or let them walk on invisible bridges to the waiting spacecraft. Among the items in the box, the scientists identified one that subdued humans in a similar way as the laser pointer discovered earlier in the program. Only this item was smaller and looked like a sewing thimble. The thimble-like object had a green glow that delivered a paralyzing sting to any animal or man regardless of their size. During testing, a large bull elephant touched by the tip of the thimble on its truck froze instantly, and became like a statue. The paralysis lasted about 5 minutes before wearing off. It had the same exact effect regardless of the size of the animal or human without any noticeable side effects. The alien thimble only had to come into brief contact with skin on any part of the body to paralyze the subject. It could be repeated several times on the same subject with the same effect without apparent harm to the animal or individual. The cigar box contained many odd-shaped objects. One of the objects, a round metallic wafer no bigger than an Indian head penny, kept a human paralyzed indefinitely when it was placed on that person's forehead. The wafer attached itself to the head like a refrigerator magnet, and kept the recipient inert until the object was removed. There were dozens of those devices inside the cigar box. Taking inventory of items in the eerie alien box was hopeless. The contents never remained the same, numerically speaking. Sometimes the box was full and other times nearly empty. One theory was that the box existed in multiple places or dimensions at the same time, making the contents available to other unknown entities. The scientists did not describe much of the other gadgets in the box in great detail, so little is known all about them. The one predictable anomaly of nearly everything alien was the returning of items that came from the craft back to the ship in 72 hours. Since objects were not removed at the same time, but were checked out individually at different times of the day, the items returned in the sequence they were taken out of their ship. At the very instant the items returned to the ship, they were available to be checked out again, and the internal clock would reset itself and begin another 72-hour countdown. There didn't seem to be a limit on how often items could be taken off the ship. Unlike humans, who pride themselves on keeping some kind of order in their homes, the pots and pans in one designated place or cabinet, the dishes and silverware in another, etc., the aliens had no such neurosis. Alien objects, gadgets and things are never found in the same place twice. Instead, they occupy different spaces, nooks, cavities, or voids in the ship each time they return. This made finding particular gadgets a frustrating challenge. Even though alien gadgets changed appearance on a regular basis, the technician that worked with a particular item for a length of time knew its abilities and functions by simply touching it. The people working with these items became intimate with them. The longer the relationship, the easier it was to recognize the specialized traits each gadget possessed. The changes in configuration of the objects were not subtle. Round items become square, or a combination of shapes, and one end of a gadget could be geometrically different than the other end. Items that had the shape of a cube may have the shape of a blowfish the next day or next minute. They even changed shape while in use, which was a dire sight to witness. Some technicians passed out while watching an item mutate in the body of a person being experimented on. Witnessing an alien item swim just under the skin of humans was an experience none of the scientists ever became comfortable with. It brought to life their cliche, "it makes my skin crawl." As bad as that was to witness, there was nothing more grotesque than watching the alien thing change geometrically while inside the person, especially if that person woke up while the transformation was in progress. The alien gadgets that entered the body were less than 2 inches long and looked like small carrots. Once they were placed on a living body, they entered through the abdomen. The end that burrowed into the skin elongates itself and then formed a tip that was finer than a hypodermic needle. Within seconds of placing the thing on the person's body, the thing inserted its tip into the skin, creating an incision the size of a pinprick. After the tip inserted itself, it sucked the remainder of its liquefied mass through the small incision. A comment from one astonished scientist who watched it: "At first it was a solid object. It then changed into a worm-like creature and began to enter into the body like a parasite. After the creature's tentacle anchored itself under the skin, the creature became balloon-like. What appeared to be solid instantly turned into a liquid, which was held in place by a thin membrane, like a water balloon. The creature transferred its liquefied contents to the inside of the human body, where it solidified. The creature then moved freely under the skin. The incision was small and there was no blood from it, and it healed at the same rate that a pinprick to the skin would. The creature, as it was called from that point on, came out of the body the same way that it entered, but not necessarily from the same location. The time that it spent inside the body varied from one individual to the next. What the creature did inside the body was not known, but the belief among the committee was that it was used as a kind of transport, carrying things into the body and probably removing things from the body. It was a blessing that in most instances, the subject who underwent this procedure was unconscious and barely holding on to life, but that was not always the case. There were a few episodes when the subject regained consciousness during an experimental procedure and was in excruciating pain from the alien object swimming inside of him. Fortunately for the scientists, the person associated his pain to his injuries and assumed that the technicians around him were doctors and nurses, since they were dressed up in the same white and green garb that the medical professionals used. The aliens apparently don't believe in anesthesiology, or the scientists had yet to identify the item that performed that specific function. From all the experiments that were done, the scientists discovered that when they anesthetized a person using the standard procedure used by doctors every day, the experiments were compromised. In each case, the alien instruments stopped what they were doing and went dormant. The alien gadgets acted as if the person had died. Because of that, the scientists concurred that the alien objects must operate on the electrical impulses of the body. When the cells are anesthetized, the neurons give off conflicting and inaccurate stimuli, making the task of the alien object impossible. Apparently, the alien objects use the cells of the body like a network of phone lines by which they navigate the whole body. From then on, the scientists did what the aliens probably did during abductions: zapped the person with the stun ray and paralyzed them. While under the alien paralysis, the person remained conscious some of the time. When he was conscious, he experienced the pain, as well as the terror that came from not knowing what was happening to him. But he could not interfere with the procedure since he was completely immobilized. Once the person was released from the paralysis, in every case, they had no recollection of what happened to them, or that anything out of the ordinary took place. Since most who were experimented on by the scientists were on their deathbed, the experimenters felt that they, the experimented on, had little to lose. In some instances, the victims had everything to gain. A number of the wounded and injured, whether from a war zone or from a car accident, recover from their wounds only because of the alien instruments and the experimentations that were done on them. When the committee was formed, the policy was that if any of the people working in that covert project became mortally ill or became damaged from an accident and were dying, that they would consent to being subjects for experimentation. The thinking of the committee was that no one should do to others what they themselves were unwilling to undergo. After carefully reviewing that proposal, many objections came to the fore. The most prevalent of those objections was outright terror. Committee members would not put themselves into a position where someday they might find themselves under the experimenter's knife, with alien creatures placed inside of them, and paralyzed so that their screams for help could not be heard by anyone, and so the proposal failed. Headline: Spontaneous Combustion. After years of handling the alien tools, the tools became more intimate with their handlers, a kind of bond formed between the gadgets and the scientists. As bizarre as it sounds, the tools shared secrets with tenured scientists that they withheld from new or unfamiliar scientists. All the alien items performed more than one function. Discovering additional traits of alien stuff came easier to some than to others. Personality played a major role in the rate of success a technician was able to achieve. If his or her demeanor was friendly and they were slow to anger, they tended to be more successful than colleagues with short fuses and hot tempers. Ironically, those chosen for that program were usually from the type of personality, very aggressive and goal-oriented, unsatisfied if they did not get quick results. They were professionals recruited from the top ranks in their fields of expertise. But they were also people with integrity and tended to be beyond reproach. Members of the committee and those who professionals that worked under them were vigorously screened and needed to have the highest level of security clearance before they were hired. All of them were believed to be of good character and goodwill, with one exclusive objective: to serve their country. Still, those who hired them were mere mortals, with their mortal tendency to fail when it came to knowing what's inside an individual's soul, whether it be good or bad. But something as simple as an alien tool or gadget knew completely the heart and mind of a man or woman, and allowed itself to be used accordingly. In other words, it was believed by the members in the committee that an evil person could not subvert the alien things, at least not the ones they were toying with. The alien things could not fall into the wrong hands as plutonium or germs used for germ warfare. The alien objects simply did not function when spite or malice was a motive, and often the gadgets turned on those who attempted such use. Nonetheless, No determination was made regarding whether the aliens were benevolent or evil beings. There was evidence indicating that they could be either one or both. Most of the items that were cataloged and identified with performing a particular function were found to be beneficial to humans. Other items performed in ways that seemed purely wicked and contradictory to the earlier findings.